Penguin Random House Audio presents The Last Ranger, a novel, by Peter Heller. Read for you by Mark Deakins. To Becky Arnold, and to her sons Landis and Thor, and to her husband Andy, in memoriam. Prologue. The night of the buffalo, it rained. Hard, flooding the creek for hours as if trying to wash away the stain. He let them in. At first he thought the knocking was the limb of the pine at the corner of the cabin. Too bad it wasn't. The two were panicked, cold. She was hyperventilating. They talked over each other. He smelled of probably bourbon. He let them lie about the accident for 10 minutes while he gave them blankets and made them coffee. He built up the fire in the stove, and then he shrugged into his slicker and pushed out into the downpour and took care of it. Poor guy. The bull had been smashed at speed in the left hind quarter, and the force had spun him into the side of the van and crushed the left side of his face, but not enough to kill him or knock him out. The cruelty of the thing. The bison was on his right side in the gravel of the shoulder, breathing in rapid, strained snorts, and Ren put a hand on his neck and said, "I'm sorry, bud. I'm so sorry. Better them than you." And he meant it. The animal's eye was intact, and in the headlights it shone black and wet, wide with desperation, maybe, or simply pain. Ren unholstered his Sig 45 and gave the animal a coup de grace. The bull heaved and scrabbled his front legs and lay still. The van was crushed along the right side and askew on the shoulder, just into the lane. In the lights of his truck, he could see skid marks to the west of the bull and the broken glass of the mirror, making it clear that the van had been traveling east. But where he found the van was again well west of the wreck and aimed west, away from help, from the nearest town by far, from the ranger station just up the road, which the couple clearly knew about because they had walked straight there in the rain. Ren swore. They had left the poor bull alive and suffering and tried to drive away. But the van had not cooperated. Ren ducked his head into the driving rain and glare of headlights and hustled back to the truck. Had the carcass been farther from people and the road, he would have left it for the wolves and bears and ravens. Instead, he radioed his friend Pete in Cook City and told him he was 0.9 miles south of the station at the fisherman's pullout, and asked him if he needed help, and Pete said, "No, take off. Aliyah and I got this. Thanks, Ren." Aliyah was Pete's 16-year-old daughter, and together they would skin the huge carcass and quarter it with a cordless meat saw and debone the quarters with knives by hand and load 200 pounds of meat into plastic tubs in the back of the truck. They would do it all in the sheeting rain, under the floodlights mounted to the rear of the ladder rack, and in 3 hours they would be heading home. Ren drove back in a blowing squall. The manic wipers couldn't keep up with the downpour, and he had to drive slowly, and as the truck crawled, his anger welled. It was the second unwarranted kill that day. In the afternoon, his neighbor, Hilly, had reported that she had found the fresh carcass of an uncollared female wolf from the Junction Butte Pack. She had been shot in the head and skinned yards from the bank of Soda Butte Creek, just inside the park. The slaying bore all the signs of a trained sharpshooter using a rifle with probably a noise suppressor. Inside the park. It was brazen poaching, and it was a fuck you to anyone who cared about the wolves. When Ren returned to the cabin, it was overheated and smelled a little of the alcohol and something else unwanted, something rancid or unwholesome. The man, Dave was his name, wasn't it, knew enough to open the damper on the wood stove to make the cabin warmer, and the fire rushed in the flue, and the base of the stovepipe was cherry red. Way too hot. They could have burned the place down. A serious fire might have been seconds away. Ren stepped fast across the rag rug, pushed past their knees in the rocking chairs, and shut the vents down. He hadn't been going to do it before, but now he did. He said, "How fast did you say you were going?" She started to speak, but the man spoke over her. 40, less, 38. How do you know? I could see the speedometer. I was driving. She had said she was the driver when they first told the story in a rush at the door. Wren took the pad from his breast pocket and wrote it down. Stand up, he said. What? Stand up, please. The man handed his mug to his wife and reluctantly stood. Walk to me, please. Wren had backed to the front door. He didn't need a painted highway line. Panic blurred the man's face, then a reddening of anger. He stepped, put one hand out as if on a high wire. Wren tugged the compact breathalyzer from his belt, handed it to the man. Blow, he said. Whoa, look, blow, Wren said. After Wren read 0.12 on the screen, he put his hands on the man's shoulders and spun him around and cuffed him. The woman was in the rocker, crying. It was too late to drive the 3 hours to Cody. He called Ty from the handset charging on the counter and said he was bringing someone in. He could be there in 40 minutes. Ty was the Park County Sheriff's deputy stationed part-time in Cook City, 20 miles to the northeast. A ranger from Yellowstone headquarters would transport the man in the morning. The man's wife was sobbing openly now, and he let her use the landline to book a room at the Super 8 that was right across the street from the two-room jail. Chapter 1. It was the anger in him that scared him. The more time he spent in Yellowstone, the more he wished that people would just go away, leave the bears, the herds of elk, the foxes, the hawks alone, the wolf packs. Yesterday morning, he had issued a summons to a man and his 9-year-old son for walking across the shallow Lamar River to within 60 yards of where the Junction Butte pack were trying to feed their pups. The river ran through open meadows here, mostly wheatgrass and sage, and on the far side they were hedged by woods that climbed steeply. The 4 hunting wolves had loped in from a fresh kill down valley, and the rest of the pack had run to meet them. 19, 20, strung out in the tall grass. The image frozen like a photograph in Wren's mind. A portrait of how the world ought to be. The wolves lean from summer, grays and blacks and buffs. One big male nearly white, sprinting flat out in what looked to be a joyous line beneath a wall of trees. They didn't have to run. But it was daybreak on a brisk mid-September morning, and the pack was all together, and there was meat. The sun had just cleared the pass, and it burnished the grass and threw the shadows of the runners ahead of them. If he himself could feel joy, it was now. And then, through the binocs, he saw the 2 figures. Man and boy already over the far bank, through the willows, stalking for a better look. Already too close. Integrity, honor, service. He would run, splash knee-deep across the river, and in 40 more yards he would hail them. Yell. The pack, which had known the 2 were coming since well before they crossed the river and decided to ignore them, had tumbled together in an exuberant moil, yelping, wrestling, but now, at the shout, they would freeze and stand and look. The father and son would turn, confused. Wren would wave them back, retrieve them, as he was trained to do. Back at the road, he would give a stern lecture about harassing wildlife and the safety of the boy and the wolves themselves, and write the man a summons that would result in a $500 fine. He would tell them that the wolves would have tolerated their proximity only so long and so close, and maybe within seconds the entire pack would have raised the alarm and moved into the trees, and that every calorie they spent retreating from the boy and the man was another calorie closer to starvation, which was true. But it was not what Wren wanted. What did he want? In a parallel life, the wolves would stand all together and turn and decide enough was enough. They would fan out in an arc, eyes steady and fast on their prey, and they would flank the father and son. And one of the fast females would feint a charge, and one of the big males would dart in behind and hamstring the man, and in minutes it would be over. Wolves had never once attacked a human in Yellowstone. In Wren's fantasy, they would spare the boy. And when Wren had shaken himself from his reverie, he thought, Jesus, what the hell has got
Sample complete. Ready to continue?